Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The DRC and Rwanda forces exchange gunfire, and U.S. lawmakers discuss a Boko Haram insurgency. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. Officials in the Democratic Republic of Congo say soldiers have exchanged gunfire with troops from neighboring Rwanda. The officials say Congolese forces opened fire early today after the Rwandans crossed the border and abducted a Congolese soldier. The pre-dawn fighting near Kibumba in the eastern province of North Kivu lasted about 4 hours. There was no immediate word on casualties. The UN mission in Congo said in a Twitter message that it is investigating. A U.S. House panel is set to get an update on Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency as residents in the northeastern Borno State region grapple with another reported kidnapping by the militant group. The House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee meets today to discuss issues, including conditions in northern Nigeria, where the militants have been most active. Congresswoman Karen Bass tells VOA the panel will also discuss U.S. efforts to help Nigeria fight the militants. The meeting comes on the heels of another suspected kidnapping by Boko Haram in the same region, where it abducted more than 200 schoolgirls in April. Iraqi security officials say Islamist militants who took over the city of Mosul on Tuesday have seized the city of Tikrit, less than 200 kilometers from Baghdad. The officials said the Sunni militants have moved southward from Mosul, taking control of Iraq's biggest refinery and Tikrit, the hometown of fallen Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Security officials said the insurgents entered the town of Beji late Tuesday, set fire to the police station and courthouse, and drove out some 250 men guarding the nation's largest oil refinery. Meanwhile, analysts warn the Iraqi government's loss of the country's second-largest city of Mosul to an al-Qaeda splinter group poses a threat not just to Iraq, but to the wider Middle East region. VOA's Victor Beatty reports.
White House spokesman Josh Earnest Tuesday condemned what he called the aggression by the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. He says it has caused a serious deterioration of the security situation in Iraq's Sunni-dominated Nineveh province.
The United States will continue to stand with the Iraqi people and provide all necessary and appropriate assistance to the government of Iraq under the Strategic Framework Agreement.
Earnest says Washington is providing Hellfire missiles, millions of rounds of small arms ammunition, thousands of rounds of tank ammunition, helicopter-fired rockets, machine guns, grenades, flares, sniper rifles, M-16s, and M4 rifles to Iraqi security forces. Victor Beatty, Washington.
Chinese officials in Beijing issued a policy paper Tuesday reminding Hong Kong residents of the city's status as part of China. The paper led to protests in Hong Kong, where pro-democracy activists say the document is intended as intimidation against supporters of broader political reforms and the former British colony. Rebecca Valley reports.
Pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong say that Beijing is twisting the meaning of one country, two systems in an effort to curb public support for greater democracy. They're responding to a rare official paper issued by China's State Council on Tuesday. In it, Beijing says the former British colony has enjoyed increased democracy and a high level of autonomy after returning to China in 1997, but also called such an autonomy not an inherent power, but one that comes solely from the authorization by the central leadership. There have been growing concerns that China's looming presence in Hong Kong's affairs could endanger the city's independent press and its vibrant civil society. Rebecca Valley reporting from Hong Kong for VOA.
Russia has warned Ukraine against refusing an offer from Moscow that would cut the price Kiev pays for gas by about 20%. President Vladimir Putin said today that Ukraine could be driving negotiations toward a dead end by asking for deeper discounts. Russian news agencies quote Mr. Putin as saying if Ukraine refuses the deal, talks will shift to a whole other level, something he said Russia does not want. The Ukrainian Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk said earlier the discount of $100 per 1,000 cubic meters is not a sustainable substitute. I'm Frances
Alonzo. That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A leading activist group is calling on the South African government to declare the country's tuberculosis epidemic a public health emergency. The Treatment Action Campaign made the plea this week at South Africa's fourth TB conference in Durban.
That's VOA's Jody Kapawa reporting. Details coming up.
Also in the news in the U.S., the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee meets today to discuss issues including conditions in northern Nigeria. And an Egyptian court sentences prominent activist Ala Abdel Fattah and 24 others to 15 years in prison.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Zambia, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, a U.S. House panel is set to get an update on Nigeria's Boko Haram insurgency as residents in the northeastern Borno State region grapple with another reported kidnapping by the militant group. The House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee meets today to discuss issues, including conditions in northern Nigeria, where the militants have been most active. Congresswoman Karen Bass tells VOA the panel will also discuss U.S. efforts to help Nigeria fight the militants. The meeting comes on the heels of another suspected kidnapping by Boko Haram in the same region where it abducted more than 200 schoolgirls in April. Witnesses say gunmen drove into the northeastern Gargan Fulani settlement and forced at least 20 women into their vehicles. They say the abductions took place on Thursday. Yesterday, National Information Center coordinator Mike O'Meary said security officials had not received any reports of a kidnapping in the region. Nigeria's military has come under growing criticism that it is not doing enough to stop attacks by Boko Haram, a group blamed for thousands of deaths during its five-year insurgency.
Truck drivers who transport humanitarian aid from Cameroon to the troubled Central African Republic have halted deliveries after suspected Seleka rebels attacked and killed three of their colleagues. The truckers say they will not go back to work unless authorities in the CAR can assure them of their safety. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Frustrated drivers are expressing anger that African peacekeepers in the Central African Republic have not protected them from the country's rebels and militia groups. One of the drivers, 52-year-old Danjuma Bello, tells VOA that he had taken the advice of the Transporters Union and will not carry goods to the CAR.
On nous a surpris comme ça là, et puis nous abandonnant les camions.
He says they were taken unaware when armed men attacked them and started shooting. He says his vehicle has holes while bullets penetrated. Bello says he narrowly missed death in last Sunday's attack, but three of his peers were killed. The drivers who transport food, relief items and other goods from Cameroon's seaport Douala say they have been victims of persistent attacks from both Seleka rebels and their anti-Balaka rivals. The president of the drivers' union, El Hajj Umaru, tells VOA that after the incident, he ordered union members to halt their deliveries.
Il s'agit encore une fois de mort d'homme. Notre chauffeur a été froidement égorgé. Pour le moment, nous avons...
He says their drivers were slaughtered and they suspended the transportation of goods to the CAR to bury their dead before examining what to do next. The union is insisting that African peacekeepers accompany and protect the drivers on the road into the capital, Bangui. Umaru says if that doesn't happen, the CAR may not be getting supplies by road for a long time to come. The landlocked CAR depends on the Douala seaport for about 95% of its supplies. For now, only a number of truckers who are not members of the union still brave the road to Bangui. 20 truck drivers have been killed along the road to Bangui since the unrest in the CAR began. Moki Edwin Kinzika, VOA News, Yaoundé.
A leading activist group is calling on the South African government to declare the country's tuberculosis epidemic a public health emergency. The Treatment Action Campaign made the plea this week at South Africa's fourth TB conference in Durban. VOA's Joe DeCapua reports.
The Treatment Action Campaign says TB is the leading cause of death in adults and children. Marcus Lowe is the group's head of policy.
South Africa has the highest TB infection rate on the planet. So in terms of absolute numbers, China and India have higher numbers. But when you take the size of our population into account, South Africa has the highest rates. And that is largely driven by our high HIV rates.
HIV attacks the immune system, making people more susceptible to TB infection. However, while TB is closely tied to HIV, it has not generated the same response.
HIV is a disease that had a significant footprint in the U.S. and Europe, so there was a lot of drug development. But TB is really a disease of poor countries, so we don't have the same investment in research and development. So we're really facing a pretty serious crisis in South Africa. We have in the region of 450,000 new infections every year, and it's the number one cause of natural death in South Africa.
The Treatment Action Campaign gained prominence in South Africa in the early years of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. It helped wage a major legal battle against the government and drug companies to make antiretrovirals more available.
We want to see the same kind of widespread social mobilization that we had around HIV, around TB. Now, in some ways, it's a bit more complicated because with HIV, if you provide people with treatment and they take it, they get well. With TB, there are many more social factors that makes it much harder to deal with.
Lowe says one of those social factors is TB among South Africa's prison population.
We have a lot of overcrowded correctional facilities in South Africa, often cells with over 200% occupancy. So that creates the ideal environment for the spread of TB and, of course, drug-resistant forms of TB. So to deal with something like that, it's not just a matter for the Department of Health. It's a matter that the Department of Justice has to look at how many people we are incarcerating. The prison system has to be reformed to ensure that we have better infection control.
Some of the very first cases of drug-resistant tuberculosis were found in the eastern rural town of Tugela Ferry in KwaZulu-Natal province. The province was also the heart of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. The World Health Organization announced in late 2006 that a deadly new strain was found there and labeled it XDR-TB, or extensively drug-resistant TB.
In South Africa, the rate of normal tuberculosis, drug-susceptible tuberculosis, seems to be stabilizing. But the really worrying thing is that the rate of drug-resistant tuberculosis is going up. You know, indications are that most of these cases are not people who are developing drug resistance. Instead, they are infected with strains of TB that are already resistant. You know, that's extremely worrying. We simply don't have very good treatments for drug-resistant TB.
The treatment is long and often not successful.
At the moment, it takes about 2 years to treat someone. There are severe side effects. They have to take something like 14,000 pills in that time and 6 months of weekly injections. So it's the one area where we really don't have an answer. Part of the problem is that TB has become a disease of poor countries, poor people. And for that reason, the pharmaceutical industry doesn't really invest in TB research anymore.
Mortality rates for multi-drug resistant and extensively drug resistant TB are very high. It's estimated 50% of those diagnosed with XDR-TB in 2010 died. Activists and researchers say because TB drugs are not profitable, research funding may have to come from organizations like the Gates Foundation or TB Alliance. South Africa's National Strategic Plan for HIV, STIs, and TB does list tuberculosis as a priority. and the country's health minister is scheduled to address the TB conference on Friday. But Treatment Action Campaign's Marcus Lowe says it can be difficult getting a national strategy implemented on the local level.
South Africa has 9 provinces, and these provinces have significant autonomy in what they do. So whereas national policy may be good, these policies may not be implemented in the various provinces. That's one kind of problem we face. The other thing is that if you want to fix the problem of TB in prisons, as I explained earlier, you need other government departments to get involved, and that unfortunately hasn't been happening in recent years.
Lowe says diagnosing and monitoring the TB epidemic have been a problem. There is new technology for rapid diagnosing called Gene Expert, but it currently looks at resistance to only one drug. And since South Africa still heavily depends on paper record keeping instead of digital, Lowe says the epidemic may be worse than currently thought. South Africa has been getting more HIV-infected people on treatment. That also offers an opportunity to screen them for TB. In its call for a TB public health emergency, the Treatment Action Campaign says we can continue to let people die of preventable TB, or we can act with urgency and determination to defeat it. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In London, the world's first summit on ending sexual violence in conflict is underway. About 1,200 government ministers, military and judicial officials, and activists from about 150 nations are attending the conference. It runs through Friday. Among those attending is actress Angelina Jolie, who is a special envoy for the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. She said that rape has nothing to do with sex. Rather, it's done to torture and humiliate people, many of whom are very young children. Jolie joined British Foreign Secretary William Hague yesterday to open the 4-day conference. Hague called for international standards on recording and investigating sex crimes to bring perpetrators in armed conflict to justice. He said the UK is committing $10 million to a fund for victims of rape in armed conflict.
An Egyptian court has sentenced 24 pro-democracy activists to 15 years in prison, marking the first punishment for activists under the regime of new president Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. Alaa Abdel Fattah and the others were sentenced today for participating in an unauthorized demonstration. Abdel Fattah was charged with organizing the protest against a new constitutional measure allowing the government to try civilians in military courts. He is considered a symbol of pro-democracy activists who ignited the political revolution in Cairo's Tahrir Square in 2011. He has been a constant critic of Egypt's rulers since the beginning of pro-democracy demonstrations that resulted in the ouster of President Hosni Mubarak 3 years ago. Today's sentences are directed beyond the Brotherhood crackdown. Observers say they are also meant to alert secular pro-democracy advocates that Egypt's new government is impatient with any public political dissent in Egypt. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehis Wuhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. In the U.S., the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee meets today to discuss issues including conditions in northern Nigeria. Truck drivers who transport humanitarian aid from Cameroon to the troubled Central African Republic have halted deliveries. And an Egyptian court has sentenced 24 pro-democracy activists to 15 years in prison. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237. The British oil company SOCO has agreed to suspend exploration activities in the Democratic Republic of Congo's Virunga National Park next month. Virunga is Africa's oldest national park and an environmentally sensitive World Heritage Site. The agreement came after months of debate and negotiation with World Wildlife Fund. WWF Director General Marco Lambertini said SOCO's concession to withdraw from the park's Lakes Albert was a victory for the planet and for good business practices. WWF filed a complaint against SOCO with the European Union's Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development 8 months ago. SOCO officials announced they would withdraw from the park after completing seismic tests in the lake. The agreement at least temporarily removes the threat of environmental damage to the 3,000 square mile park. SOCO Chairman Rui de Sousa said their continued interest is based on Congo's need for revenues and UNESCO's goals of regional and environmental development.
A new book was launched yesterday in Rome that examines the challenges and opportunities facing millions of small-scale farmers. The Rome-based International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, launched the book New Directions for Small-Scale Agriculture. It features small farming communities in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, where farmers are facing similar challenges such as environmental risks, land tenancy disputes, and difficulty with access to credit and markets. Gary Howe is head of strategy and knowledge at IFAD. He highlighted some of the findings of the research done for the book on small-scale farmers, particularly those in Africa.
I think that the principal finding is that they're critical for food supplies for the continent. They account for perhaps 80% of all the food consumed in Africa, not only in the countryside, of course, but also in the growing cities. I think that it also underlined the fact that there's a potential for the small-scale farmers to be even a more dynamic element of the situation. Many of them are operating with very little support in terms of access to markets, in terms of technology, in terms of access to finance. And the sense is that with an appropriate policy framework and with investment, this smallholder sector can be one of the growth engines of African development.
How do you get countries then to focus on the small-scale farmers who are providing, like you said, 80% of the food for the people?
Well, I think governments confront many, many difficult policy choices. They have the requirements of expanding urban areas. They have social sector requirements to it for investment, etc. And what we're suggesting is that actually they look at the small-scale agriculture not as a social welfare area or an area of poverty which needs transfers, but an investment area. We see that a really leading element of Africa today is the growing urban areas, and we're talking with them, and I think they're well appreciating the fact that in order for cities to grow, the countryside must develop as well to feed them. African countries, in particular, 10 years ago in Maputo, really made an important decision to invest 10% of their budgets each year in the rural areas, particularly in agriculture. And many, many of them are actually doing that. So I think the issue is not so much convincing governments the smallholder sector is important, but convincing them that it's a vital contributor to their long-term development.
Outside of this, what else can be done to help small-scale farmers be able to have a sustainable living?
I think the most important thing we can do is to understand who small-scale farmers are. Small-scale farmers in Africa, Asia, are small businesses, and they have the same requirements that other small businesses have. They have a requirement for access to financial services, to roads, to get to market, clarity in land titles so that they can invest with confidence. I think there's a great deal that can be done, and that is, in fact, is being done. I think the principal story today is to look at the smallholder sector in a different way. For a long, long time, it was seen as somehow not a development force, but as something which was necessary, but it was not going to transform Africa. I think we have a very different perspective today. And I think that one of the key variables is not so much government policy, although that's critical, nor indeed international assistance, although that's important, but to develop linkages between the private sector and the small farmer. You know, the private sector is absolutely fundamental in food distribution and food processing, which is becoming such an important part of African economies, just as they are elsewhere. And the task here is not to try and develop the smallholders separately from that sort of private investment, but to forge connections between them.
Another factor to consider when you're talking about small-scale farmers, at least I know for Africa, is that the majority of them are women. Does the fact that they're women make it more difficult to be able to get the resources they need, such as financing, credit, and getting to markets?
Women have always played a very, very important part in agriculture throughout the world. In Africa today, they probably play the predominant role. Their men are migrating, they're doing different things, and women are really the backbone of African agriculture. So the question then becomes, well, what are the specific elements of the situation of women that can facilitate becoming more productive, earn more, feed the cities better? And they're the sorts of issues that we know everywhere. It's the question of land title. Do they have land? Can they effectively make the management decisions on land? Can they use land as collateral when they go to the banks? Do they have access to the sorts of education which is required for the modern small business? These are very, very simple things, and yet in many areas a great deal rests to be done.
When you're looking at the future of the small-scale farmers, what do you see? Is there hope that they will be able to grow?
What is very, very interesting is that in many parts of the world, particularly in Africa, but not exclusively there, there's a big gap between the productivity of large farms and small farms, at least in terms of the productivity of labor. And that doesn't reflect anything specific about the smallholder condition. It reflects the fact that technology has not really been extended in a systematic way. We see really quite a dynamic role. Now, what one would see usually is that the smallholder sector would get more specialized. People would stop producing nearly everything that they require in terms of food. They will start to specialize in particular crops and then exchange with other regions for the things that they need themselves. So I think what we will see is a smallholder sector which is very, very much connected to the private sector, in both in terms of marketing and in terms of inputs, and a private sector which was much more technologically savvy than we've seen in many places for a long time.
That was Gary Howe, Head of Strategy and Knowledge at the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD. He spoke with me from Rome.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks. Get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah, now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
I feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
Put your flags up in the sky.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
VOA podcasts are a convenient way to get your information on the run.
VOANews.com.
Visit VOANews.com and click on podcasts to learn how you can subscribe.
Thank you.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. In the U.S., the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee meets today to discuss issues including conditions in northern Nigeria. And an Egyptian court sentences prominent activist Ala Abdel Fattah and 24 others to 15 years in prison. Coming up, we'll have music from Zambia. And in our feature segment, we focus on the plight of thousands of migrants making the perilous sea crossing from Libya to Italy this year. I'm Kim Lewis with Nehaus Vuhid, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I guess we can say that World Cup fever is now simmering.
Simmering indeed, Kim. World Cup fever. And joining us once again on The Voice of America is our football guru, David Legg. Sporty World Cup greetings, David.
Thank you, Sunny.
David, football's 32 nation jamboree. The World Cup officially kicks off on Thursday with the host country Brazil taking on Croatia. The Brazilians going for a record extending sixth World Cup trophy. How do you see this match, David?
Only one result, Sonny. It has to be a Brazilian victory. I was just thinking before I came on air with you, I cannot remember a World Cup going back a long, long way where one country has been the overwhelming favorites to win. And in this case, of course, that's Brazil, as you said, already winners of the trophy five times. They're the host nation. South Africa was quite open, even though Germany were hosts in 2006. It was certainly not a foregone conclusion that they would win. And in fact, they ended up only finishing third. Very open in 2002 in South Korea and Japan, where Brazil did emerge victorious, but they certainly were not overwhelming favorites. And 1998, again, a big turn-up. France hosts, but were not really the favorites, although they ended up hammering Brazil in the final. So in that sense, Sonny, very unusual. And, of course, also now, huge pressure on Brazil. To me, it's the absolutely worst position to be in when you're such overwhelming favorites going into this first match, not only to win the game, not only to win the group, but to actually win the tournament. On the other hand, Croatia are, I guess, in a really nice position. They've got nothing whatsoever to lose because everybody expects them to lose anyway. And what I hope the Croatians have done is watch the recent friendly between Brazil and Serbia. Now, Serbia and Croatia, both part of the former Yugoslavia, so blood brothers in many senses and a similar style of football. And Serbia did a really good job on Brazil. Brazil eventually won the match 1-0, but the Serbians had their chances. And as far as containment was concerned, the Serbians gave some strong hints out for the Croatians. Clearly, what you cannot do is go at the Brazilians at breakneck pace, because then you're going to open up the likes of Neymar are going to pick off goal after goal. What the Serbians did, Sonny, they played cautiously, but they counterattacked with great speed and had several opportunities of their own. But unfortunately for the Serbians, early in the second half, Fred, he managed to poke the ball into the net after a cross. And of course, you always run that risk when you play very cautiously. But I would imagine the Croatians have watched that DVD of that game over and over and over again, because I think the Serbians, they certainly could have taken a draw from that match. They were never outclassed. Prior to that, the Brazilians had had a match against Panama. Now, that game, they won by 4-0. But I think the Serbian friendly was the more realistic one. Croatia, Sonny, well, their best performance was in 1998. They reached the semi-finals. They struggled a bit this time round. They needed to go to the playoffs. And there they beat Iceland to qualify for Brazil. But logically, you have to go for a Brazilian victory. I'm hearing people talking of 4-5, 6-0. I don't see it like that. The figure that sticks in my mind is maybe Brazil 2-0. I think it'll be fairly close. And that's the one that gets, as you said, the jamboree underway. 32 nations all chasing that trophy, the symbol of world football supremacy.
David, you mentioned Neymar and the huge pressure facing this Brazilian team. Among the Brazilian players, is Neymar facing the most pressure?
I think so, Sonny. He's very much their golden boy. He's not an awful lot behind the likes of Messi and Ronaldo in terms of the popularity stakes. And there's no doubt that he is the player the Brazilians are expecting to produce the guts. He's incredibly talented, but he does tend to drift in and out of games. And certainly the Serbians, without man marking him, kept a very close eye on him and contained him pretty well. But the one area where he is pretty lethal, Sonny, given half a chance, is free kicks. Now, I think they're going to have quite a decisive role in this World Cup, particularly in the latter stages when matches are really tight. And where Neymar is particularly dangerous is those free kicks just a little bit outside the penalty area, because that gives them a chance to get the ball up and down. What I've noticed with the set pieces, if they're right on the edge of the penalty area, the players actually are less effective because they battle to get the ball up over the wall and then down quickly past the goalkeeper. But Neymar scored an absolute peach against Panama from a free kick. I'm guessing it was about 30 metres from goal. That's one of the problems, Sonny. He's a great dribbler, and the Serbians certainly did a lot of it. They hacked him down, and that, of course, created these set-piece situations. So it's a bit of a catch-22. If you let him dribble, he's an immediate and present danger. And if you hack him down, he's a danger anyway from the set-piece. So not sure quite how you deal with Mr. Neymar.
Thanks, David. That's our football guru, David Legg, and we'll hear more soccer-licious insights from David during the month-long World Cup in Brazil. The San Antonio Spurs spanked the two-time defending champion Miami Heat 111-92 to take a 2-1 lead in the National Basketball Association Finals. VOA's Tati Abeje tells us more about San Antonio's big victory in Game 3.
For the Heat, it was a stunning defeat. The team was playing in front of a home crowd. It had the momentum on its side after winning Game 2 last Sunday, and they were the strong favorites to win. But that's not what happened last night at the American Airlines Arena. The game belonged to the San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs came out hot in the first quarter, and they never looked back. They moved the ball at will, and they made big shots. Their defense was impressive, forcing 20 Heat turnovers. The Spurs' scoring statistics were also impressive. They made a finals record 75.8% of their shots in the first half. They also scored 71 points in the first half, the largest NBA Finals first half record in 26 years. At one point, the Spurs even led the Heat by 25 points. Perhaps the most impressive performance was that of small forward Kawhi Leonard. He set the tone early and often. He scored a game-high 29 points on 10 of 13 shots from the field. He also did a great job defending Heat star LeBron James. Danny Green and Tony Parker added 15 points each. Tim Duncan added 14 points and 6 rebounds. After the game, Kawhi Leonard talked about his performance.
I just was able to get in a rhythm tonight, both in game 1 and 2. Got in some foul trouble, so I was getting subbed out pretty early. So just tonight, I got in a rhythm and I knocked down shots early.
On the other hand, the Heat's performance in front of their home crowd was embarrassing. Their offense played solid, but their defense, well, it's like it never showed up. They gave up too many easy baskets and open 3-point shots. LeBron James and Dwayne Wade each scored 22 points. Rashard Lewis had 14 points, including 4 3-point shots. The other players, including Chris Bosh, were ineffective as they combined for 33 points. Miami Heat head coach Eric Spoelstra expressed his disappointment at how his team played.
Came out at a different gear than what we were playing at, and it just seemed we were on our heels the most part of the first half. And then when we started to get to a different gear in the third quarter, it was just tough to change the energy of the game.
Spoelstra says his team must play a lot better for them to win. The Heat now go back to the drawing board to determine what adjustments they need to play better in Game 4. Coach Spoelstra feels his team will do better and tie the series up in Game 4. The role players' performance will remain a major factor as the Heat look forward to the remaining games. Game 4 takes place Thursday night in Miami, Florida. For the Sunny Side of Sports, I'm VOA's.
Thanks, Tati. As Tati mentioned, the Heat play their home games at American Airlines Arena in Miami, Florida. Former England star David Beckham was hoping to build a new waterfront stadium next to the Heat's basketball arena for an expansion Major League Soccer club in Miami. But Beckham's plan has suffered a setback. Miami City officials have rejected the proposed venue, describing it as an inappropriate location. Beckham's ownership group says it'll now spend the next few months weighing alternative locations in Miami. Meanwhile, Beckham says he's optimistic about England's chances at the World Cup in Brazil. England is grouped with Uruguay, Costa Rica, and Italy for the first round of the international football fiesta. And the Brits kick off their World Cup campaign with a real cracker, as the lads in London like to say. They'll play the Italians June 14th in Manaus in the Amazon region of Brazil. And if you're keeping score at home, World Cup fans, I was a young lad of 5 years old when England achieved its greatest World Cup glory back in 1966 when they hosted the tournament and lifted the trophy at Wembley Stadium in London. Before a crowd of 98,000, England defeated the then West Germany 4-2 in extra time.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled World Cup Goal Line Technology, and the technology will be used for the first time in Brazil at football's premier event. 14 cameras, 7 focused on each goal mouth, will be used at all 12 World Cup stadiums in Brazil. The cameras will record 500 images each second, and a computer will process the frames. Within a second of a ball crossing the line, the referee's special watch will vibrate and flash goal. The small German startup company Goal Control created the technology, which has been used for years in sports such as cricket, rugby, tennis, and American-style football. On the eve of the World Cup, the company demonstrated the goal line technology at Brazil's famous Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro, where the final will be played July 13th. Goal! Goal! I rule that a goal. The technology says so. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahya Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
In our feature segment, South Sudan officials try to defuse escalating tensions between roaming armed cattle herders and farmers. And next, we look at the plight of thousands of migrants making the perilous sea crossing from Libya to Italy. But first, some music. Here is J.K. Danny of Zambia with Leke Nsambe.
Boy, hola, kwa baza sana, le mona shani, yose kula imbafi, too much of anything is bad.
Yo, what about you?
J.K. Danny of Zambia with Leke Sambe.
In western equatorial state of South Sudan, officials are trying to defuse escalating tensions between roaming armed cattle herders and farmers. Officials are concerned that the situation could escalate into violence if the two sides can't reach a compromise. From Washington, reporter Nabil Biagio has more.
Since fighting erupted in South Sudan in mid-December, cattle herders fleeing violence in Jungle and Upper Nile states moved to Mundri, Tore Wandi, and other counties in western Equatorial State where they found safer grazing land. But residents, who are mainly farmers, complain that the herders are trespassing and destroying their farms. Bangazi Joseph Bakosoro, state governor of western Equatoria, says the tension between farmers and herders could erupt into communal fighting if not contained soon.
The community can explode in time, but as long as we are arguing with our community not to resort to violence but to negotiation, probably if the cattle owners understand our position, they will begin to return to their locations.
Bakosoro says residents of the state do not feel safe because armed militias have been spotted with the cattle.
Some of them are civilians, some of them are armed. They are moving with the cattle, which is threatening the security of the state and the citizens.
Bakosoro says the government is initiating meetings between local chiefs and the cattle herders, who are assuring the herders that the fighting that drove them out is over and it's now safe to go back home.
What we are arguing is to negotiate their return back to their locations.
Western Equatorial State Assembly member Stephen Kayanga says the problem is that the cattle were brought in such huge numbers, which makes it difficult to control them.
So sometimes cattle can go astray and destroy crops of people.
And Kayanga says when the crops are destroyed, the locals have nothing left.
Because those people are farmers and they don't want their farm to be destroyed by the cattle.
A member of the National Assembly in Western Equatorial State recalls a similar situation of tension between farmers and herders back in 2005 that was resolved peacefully. Joseph Ingere sat on a committee tasked to resolve the situation in Mundri County when a huge influx of pastoralists poured into the region just after the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement.
Actually, as one of the people who went to resolve the situation, most of the cattle camps went, but there was some few cattle camps and the locals who had a conflict and a physical fought. So that one has been resolved because there was a reconciliation and peace conferences which were held
and peace committees were formed to monitor this.
Ngere says he hopes they can repeat what happened in 2005.
Through the chiefs, the peace committees, and also the local chiefs themselves, they have the committees of elders, and there are local administrative units like the Boma administrators, the Kayama administrators. Once they are there, they sit down together with elders to sort out the situation.
So far, no violence has been reported, but residents say they won't rest easy until the situation is resolved peacefully. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
The International Organization for Migration reports that tens of thousands of migrants have been rescued while making the perilous sea crossing from Libya to Italy this year. The agency attributes this to a rescue operation initiated by Italy in late 2013. Lisha Schlein reports from Geneva.
This past weekend, more than 3,000 boat people who crossed the Mediterranean from North Africa managed to reach Italy. Their arrival in Sicily put the number of migrants who have successfully made this perilous journey to more than 40,000 in the first 5 months of this year. That is close to the 42,000 total for all of 2013, reported by the International Organization for Migration. Most arrive in Italy from Libya, often in unsafe smugglers' boats. IOM spokeswoman Christiane Bertillon says the dramatic rescue of some 40,000 boat people this year is a result of the so-called Mare Nostrum operation started by Italy in October. She says this followed the tragic drowning of nearly 400 people when their boat caught fire and nobody was there to help.
They have huge ships that patrol the Mediterranean Sea, even in international waters, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They take the boat people, they rescue them. On this boat, they have medical facilities, they have staff that are trained to help those people, and they bring them to Sicily.
IOM says the more than 3,000 migrants rescued on Friday and Saturday included Syrians, Moroccans, Egyptians, Eritreans, Somalis, Nigerians, and other sub-Saharan nationals. The migrants told their rescuers they did not want to stay in Libya because of insecurity, so they set out for Italy, many hoping to go on from there to other European countries. Bertium says it is very difficult to stop people from taking the perilous journey across the Mediterranean despite the risks.
And you have all these young people in the south who are fleeing violence, but not only violence. Most of them, the big majority, are migrants that are fleeing poverty and are ready to take incredible risk to get a better life for them and for their children. You know, one has to be highly desperate to take one of those boats and even bring with him his wife and his children and risk the life of all the family. It's because they're very desperate.
IOM says permanent solutions must be found to end irregular migration. The agency says it is up to the countries of origin, transit, and destination to enact policies to manage and regularize migration for the benefit of all. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacked by a militant extremist group, the East African nation of Somalia nevertheless has made important strides since completing its political transition in 2012. A new federal parliament and speaker were elected, a provisional constitution adopted, a new president elected, and new prime minister and cabinet named. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are hopeful signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's faith that better times are ahead, President Barack Obama will soon name a U.S. ambassador to serve there, boosting our relations further. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then growing instability, a Nairobi-based special representative and supporting staff for many years traveled back and forth to Mogadishu to advance U.S. interests in Somalia. When the new ambassador is named, that system will continue. But as conditions continue to improve, it's envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in the capital. That will give our diplomats, aid administrators, and other U.S. personnel increased contact with Somalis and Somalia's leaders and oversee continued U.S. support. In announcing the decision, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman cautioned that while Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists, Al-Shabaab, have been weakened, but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal test for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and other international partners, the undersecretary said. Somalis will have to decide for themselves whether they want to exist as a loose community of separate clans, isolated from the world and in conflict with each other, or as a united nation with all the attributes, benefits, and responsibilities that such unity brings.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.